Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The top military commander of Syria's Al-Qaeda-affiliated Nusra Front was killed Thursday in an attack apparently targeting a high-level meeting of the group. Abu Humam al-Shami died along with several other Nusra Front members. State-run Syrian media report that government forces carried out the strike against the militants in Idlib province. The Palestine Liberation Organization has called on President Mahmoud Abbas to halt security cooperation with Israel in apparent retaliation for Israel's freezing Palestinian tax revenue. The PLO's Central Council made its recommendation Thursday after a two-day meeting. It cites what it calls Israel's failure to abide by agreements signed between the two sides. Israel withheld badly needed tax revenue from the Palestinians in January after the Palestinian Authority announced it would seek to join the International Criminal Court, a move strongly opposed by Israel and the U.S. The head of UNESCO has condemned the bulldozing of the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud in northern Iraq by Islamic State militants, saying the deliberate destruction of cultural heritage constitutes a war crime. UNESCO is determined to do whatever is needed to document and protect the heritage of Iraq and lead the fight against the illicit traffic of cultural artifacts, which directly contributes to the financing of terrorism, Irina Bokova said Friday. She is the chief of the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. This is VOA News. A leaked African Union report calls for South Sudan's president and his main rival to be barred from a transitional government and for the war-torn country to be placed under AU control. Reuters news agency published an account of the report Friday as another round of talks to end South Sudan's 15-month conflict ended in Addis Ababa without a peace deal. According to Reuters, the report says President Salva Kiir and former deputy-turned-rebel leader Riek Machar should be barred from roles in a transitional executive body, along with all ministers in power, before the cabinet was dissolved in 2013. The report recommends creation of an AU-appointed and UN-backed panel to oversee a five-year transition for South Sudan. Unemployment in the United States dropped in February, and the economy had a net gain of 295,000 jobs. Friday's report from the Labor Department says the jobless rate fell to 5.5%. While the data showed a stronger job market than most economists had predicted, there are still 8.7 million people unemployed. That is slightly lower than the previous month and down 1.7 million from a year ago. There were also 6.6 million people who work part-time and want full-time jobs. South Korean police said on Friday they are investigating possible links between the North Korean government and a man who attacked the U.S. ambassador to Seoul. Authorities also said 55-year-old Kim Gi-hong faces possible attempted murder charges after slashing Ambassador Mark Lippert on the face and wrist. Ambassador Lippert said Thursday he is doing well and in great spirits, and later wrote on Twitter that he would soon return to advance U.S.-South Korean relations. United Nations-led peace talks for Libya entered their second day Friday in Morocco, the official Moroccan news agency reported, a day after the UN envoy to Libya said he believes an agreement is possible. Bernardino León and UN mediators met separately Thursday with delegates from the Libyan government and Islamic extremists who have taken over the capital, Tripoli, and set up a separate administration. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny was released from prison Friday after serving a 15-day sentence for handing out leaflets in the Moscow subway advertising an opposition rally. Speaking to supporters, Navalny said the murder of fellow opposition leader Boris Nemtsov would not force him to back off from his campaign against President Vladimir Putin's government. Navalny also said he would pay a visit to the cemetery where Nemtsov was buried. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Talks to end 15 months of conflict in South Sudan broke down Friday, a day after an international deadline to reach a peace deal came and went. IGAD, the East African bloc mediating the talks, will now have to decide the way forward.
That's Marta van der Werf reporting. We'll have full details coming up. Also, Cameroon launches an $8 million emergency plan for 70,000 students displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. Fuel shortages in Nigeria could impact the economy ahead of elections. And as we celebrate International Women's Day, the International Labor Organization reports women are still losing out in the global marketplace. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, talks to end 15 months of conflict in South Sudan broke down today, a day after an international deadline to reach a peace deal came and went. IGAD, the East African bloc mediating the talks, will now have to decide the way forward. Marta van der Werf reports from Addis Ababa, where negotiations have been going on for the past 2 weeks.
South Sudan's President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar walked away from the negotiation table Friday afternoon in Addis Ababa. They could not reach an agreement even with a one-day extension on a March 5th deadline set by the United Nations Security Council. Rebel leader Machar blames the government for the impasse.
We have done our best to arrive to a peace agreement, but it has not become possible. Because the positions being presented by the government, that we are not accepting defeat. The Prime Minister promised that there will be a new mechanism for the talks. So we will wait to when this new mechanism is going to be formed to continue the peace talks.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn was present during Friday's face-to-face talks. He told both leaders that prolonging the war is unacceptable both morally and political, and that the regional mediation body IGAD will hold the parties to their commitment to form a transitional government by July of this year. He further said that he will consult with regional heads of states in the coming days with the intention to implement a common plan. South Sudan's Minister of Information, Michael McQuay, says more time is needed for the sides to work out disagreements over the structure of a unity government, including the ratio of power sharing and institutional reforms. He refused to call the talks failed.
We cannot say that there is a failure, but there is a progress being made. So we are optimistic that after consultations and when we are called back, definitely, we will be in a position to agree and take peace to our people in South Sudan.
Because of the failure to reach a comprehensive deal by March 5, the UN Security Council can now impose travel and financial sanctions on individuals seen as obstructing the peace process. South Sudan only gained independence from Sudan in 2011. A political rift between President Kiir and Machar triggered the ongoing conflict, with tens of thousands killed and nearly 2 million people displaced. Marta van der Werf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
The UN envoy to Libya says an agreement between warring factions is possible after yesterday's peace negotiations in Morocco. Bernardino Leon says the mood among parties was positive and constructive. Representatives of Libya Dawn and Libya Dignity militias and the leaders of two rival governments met near Rabat to discuss a ceasefire. Rival groups met in separate rooms yesterday and were scheduled to meet again today. Leon says they hope to identify a national personality to form a government of national unity and declare a ceasefire. However, representatives of Libya Dawn forces said the new role of former Muammar Gaddafi ally Khalifa Haftar as the military leader of the internationally recognized parliament will make agreement more difficult. Last year, Haftar began his own military campaign against Islamist militants in Benghazi. His critics in the remnants of Tripoli's General National Congress call him a war criminal. Hours before yesterday's meetings in Morocco, warplanes from both factions continued to bomb Mitiga. oil ports in the east, and an airport in the western town of Zintan. Nigerian military intelligence says Boko Haram fighters are massing in the city of Gwoza for a possible showdown with the Nigerian military and a new regional force created to defeat the Islamist extremist. Chadian forces are reported near the city. Gwoza is a city about 250,000 near the Cameroonian border. The city has served as Boko Haram headquarters since the insurgents declared a large portion of northwestern Nigeria an Islamist caliphate last year. More than 300 residents were gathered in the Gwoza city center and shot to death in June of last year. Thousands of residents fled. The military source says the rebels have recently planted landmines around the town. More than 45 residents of Njaba, a remote village in neighboring Borno State, were killed by Boko Haram forces in a dawn raid on Tuesday. Survivors reached the state capital Maiduguri yesterday, said the rebels shot men, most of them teenagers, in their homes and then burned the town down. Members of a multinational joint military force, including Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, say they have retaken a number of towns on the shores of Lake Chad. Nigeria claims it is now in control of Mafa, a town not far from Maiduguri. Experts say, however, that as Boko Haram is pushed out of strongholds in the region, Nigeria will be faced with increased suicide bombings in the cities and attacks on remote towns. Boko Haram's six-year insurgency has led to the deaths of thousands and displaced over 1.5 million people. Well, Cameroon has launched an $8 million emergency plan to construct 200 classrooms, dormitories, and latrines for 70,000 students displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. The schools will be constructed in safer localities in Cameroon, away from the volatile northern region near the Nigerian border. Moki Edwin Kinziga reports from Yaoundé.
The governor of the far north region of Cameroon, Mijiyawa Bakari, says the school children were displaced from 170 schools destroyed by Boko Haram fighters on Cameroon's border with Nigeria. He says schools in safer Cameroonian localities can no longer accommodate the increasing numbers of students, and he has given out contracts for classrooms, latrines and dormitories to be built.
Les opérateurs économiques qui ont une crédibilité pour que...
He says he has given the contracts to credible businessmen who can complete the work in 40 days so the children can go back to school. Businessman Ge Foncha, who is to supply the schools with electricity, says the government has facilitated their work by reducing administrative bottlenecks in procurement processes.
Jusqu'à cette vendredi, tous les fouilles se seront faites.
He says as of Friday, they will start transporting electricity cables and poles to the construction sites, and that he thinks 80% of the work will be complete in 3 weeks. The government has already deployed the military to the selected sites. Cameroon's far north delegate of basic education, Ibrahim Joel Mahamat, says nearly half of the children displaced are primary school students.
Il y a presque 33,000 élèves déplacés.
He says he is very optimistic that very soon the 33,000 children displaced from primary schools on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria will have good classrooms so they can study in safer localities. The displaced school children are among the 150,000 people who have been chased out of their homes since the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram started attacking Cameroon in its fight to create an Islamist caliphate. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
Nigeria is suffering from a gasoline shortage as falling oil prices have affected the country's ability to import and distribute refined fuels. Coming just weeks before elections scheduled for March 28th, the shortage could have a big impact on the campaign trail, Henry Ridgewell reports.
In Abuja, the lines of cars waiting for gas are growing longer. Acute fuel shortages are gripping towns and cities across the country. Workers reliant on their cars are losing money fast, like taxi driver Bartholomew Ode Akpa.
I work at the airport as a car hire. Now, I'm supposed to be in my at the airport now, but there's no way for me, no fuel for me to go and look for something to do.
Nigeria is one of the world's top producers of crude oil and exports around 2 million barrels per day, but it doesn't have the refinery capacity to meet fuel demand, so it relies on imports. That makes the country vulnerable to a turbulent market, says Virginia Kamoli of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Although Nigeria has tried over the past few years to diversify its economy, 80% of government revenues are still dependent on the oil industry.
The falling oil price has hit Nigeria's currency, the Naira, and traders say government fuel subsidies are not being paid. The CEO of the Seplat Petroleum Development Company, Austin Avuru, is calling on the government to boost domestic refining capacity.
Then you find out that the boom and bust elements of changes in crude oil prices will have much more negligible impact on our GDP growth than you have it today. And I think that's our countries should be moving in terms of how they manage their natural resources.
Nigerian Minister of Aviation Osita Benjamin Chidoka told VOA President Goodluck Jonathan is trying to reduce Nigeria's dependence on crude oil production.
One of our major foreign currency earners is oil, but it's also an opportunity for Nigeria. It creates an opportunity that luckily for us, our president has committed to improving agriculture over the past few years. Diversifying the economy, removing the subsidies that are kind of fueling a dependency culture.
The timing is difficult for President Goodluck Jonathan as he campaigns, trying to secure another 4 years in office. The elections have already been postponed once due to insecurity caused by the Boko Haram insurgency. It's not only Nigeria that is suffering, says Virginia Kamoli.
Other regional countries, countries that export their goods into Nigeria, will suffer from a reduction in demand from the Nigerian market.
Analysts warn that continued low oil prices have the potential to cause unrest because the government will be forced to cut back on public spending. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 18 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Talks to end 15 months of conflict in South Sudan broke down today, a day after an international deadline to reach a peace deal came and went. The UN envoy to Libya says an agreement between warring factions is possible after yesterday's peace negotiations in Morocco. And Cameroon launches an $8 million emergency plan for 70,000 students displaced by the Boko Haram insurgency. And for more on our stories and our latest updates, log on to our website at voaafrica.com. After a closely fought February 28th snap election in Lesotho, the Democratic Congress this week has cobbled together a coalition government with minor parties. It will be Lesotho's second ever coalition. However, the same problems that propelled the acrimonious breakdown of government last year threaten the new government as well. Jillian Parker has more from Johannesburg.
The elections pitted the All Basotho Convention under incumbent Prime Minister Thomas Dabane against its main rivals, the Democratic Congress, led by former Prime Minister Pakalitha Musasidi, and the Lesotho Congress for Democracy, led by the then Deputy Prime Minister Mothajoan Mitsing. Musasidi's DC won the most seats, but failed to hit the magic number of 61 for an outright victory, prompting furious political negotiations. Lesotho had not meant to go to the polls until 2017, but a political crisis struck last year. Looming defections from the tripartite coalition and a threatened no-confidence vote prompted Prime Minister Dabane to suspend Parliament. By August, Dabane had fled to South Africa, claiming a military faction had attempted a coup. the Southern African Development Community intervened, with South Africa's Deputy President, Cyril Ramaphosa, brokering a deal to reopen Parliament and hold elections 2 years early. Speaking after the new coalition was announced this week, Ramaphosa said the vote was credible and the new government had its work cut out.
Lesotho should begin the process of embarking on some reforms at the constitutional level as well as at the security level, so as to ensure that we do not have a similar situation occurring again.
Critics say the SADC mission failed to tackle the fundamental issues. One is the ill-defined roles of Lesotho's army and police. Another is that the constitution does not address what should happen to a coalition government should an MP decide to cross the floor and join another party. Dimfo Mutsamai, an analyst from the Institute of Security Studies Africa, says a prime minister beholden to a coalition is vulnerable to political blackmail.
The coalition is fickle because the kingmakers are the small parties. If they feel that they cannot get what they want, they will broker a different deal with probably the opposition. There are no legal instruments that protect coalition governments. There is no floor-crossing legislation or legislation that prevents floor-crossing. So the likelihood of defections from the coalition partners to other parties is very, very likely.
What Sami says, another indicator that there could be similar problems ahead for this coalition is the fact that the two major political parties, the LCD and DC, which garnered the most votes, decided against an alliance.
It really continues on the trend of Lesotho politics, which are largely adversarial politics as opposed to focusing on a common vision for the country and focusing on policy issues that will move the country's governance forward.
The ABC's anti-corruption drive that had led to investigations into various opposition politicians are likely to be buried by the new administration. Investigations into the army's role last August will be swept to one side, say analysts. Lesotho journalist Marfaeli Mohobole says the public is sceptical about the government's ability to rule effectively.
People never wanted to go for elections. They still feel that politicians acted out of greed for power and not for them as people. We're going to see another marriage of convenience. It's very imminent already that people already have their say on it, that it's not going to last.
The constitution stipulates that a government be formed within 14 days after the Independent Electoral Commission announces the outcome of an election. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. A new study shows during the past two decades, there has been little progress in women's participation in the labor market and in narrowing the gender wage gap. As we celebrate International Women's Day, the International Labor Organization reports women continue to suffer from widespread discrimination and inequality in the workplace. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The International Labor Organization says women are marginally better off now than they were 20 years ago when a far-reaching agenda for advancing gender equality and women's empowerment was adopted in Beijing. The agency reports women in most parts of the world remain undervalued. It says they are stuck in low-paid jobs, lack access to education, and have limited bargaining and decision-making power. It says most unpaid work falls on the shoulders of women, who are mainly responsible for caring for the family, the elderly, and the sick. The report notes more women than ever are working. Nevertheless, it says the gap in labor market participation rates between men and women has decreased by only 1%. ILO economists estimate reducing this gap by 25% in G20 countries by 2025 would add more than 100 million women to the labor force. Meanwhile, ILO Gender Equality and Diversity Branch Chief Shauna Olney says maternity protection has improved.
The percentage of countries offering at least 14 weeks of maternity leave has increased from 38 in 1994 to 51% as of last year. Though, we still have 800,000 women who do not have adequate maternity protection. 80% of those are in Africa and Asia. We also have much more paternity leave. So men are being acknowledged as having a role in the family much more over the last 20 years. 1994, we had 28% of countries offering paternity leave. There's now 56%.
The report says women earn on average 77% of what men earn, and that gap is widening for higher-earning women. The ILO notes pay equity will not be achieved for more than 70 years if targeted action is not taken. Furthermore, a new paper on the motherhood pay gap finds mothers often earn less than women without children, depending on where they live and how many children they have. But other studies show that fathers earn more than men who do not have children. Olney tells VOA discrimination against women in the workplace harms the social and economic well-being of society.
Economies that have gender gaps in the labor market suffer from a GDP loss of up to 27% in certain regions. We see that initial findings that increased female labor participation could substantially reduce poverty. It's also a business issue. We see that companies with top quartile representation of women in executive committees outperform companies with no women at the top by an increase of 47% average return on equity and 55% return on average earnings.
Another issue of great concern is violence in the workplace. The ILO says some 35% of all women are victims of physical and/or sexual violence that affects their attendance at work. It says violence has a high cost for workers, employers, and society generally. The UN agency is calling for laws and policies to prevent and protect against harassment and other forms of violence in the world of work. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
VOA Africa presents a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control.
Many Ebola patients who are treated in hospital will survive and recover. Ebola is a serious disease, but when people have recovered, the doctors test them, and when the disease is all gone, they are discharged. The discharged patients cannot transmit Ebola. The virus has left their bodies, and they cannot pass Ebola to anyone. Not their children, their other family members, people sitting next to them in the taxi or bus. Partners, however, must abstain or always use a condom for sex for 3 months after discharge from the health center. And remember, with the right information and together with our healthcare workers, we can protect ourselves from Ebola.
That was a message in the public interest from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, brought to you by VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top story this hour. Talks to end 15 months of conflict in South Sudan broke down today, a day after an international deadline to reach a peace deal came and went. And coming up, we'll have music from Liberia and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with South Africa and the Commonwealth Games.
Kim, South Africa's coastal city of Durban is hoping to deliver Africa's first Commonwealth Games in 2022. South African singers, dancers, and drummers added a festive and musical atmosphere to this week's ceremony in London, where Durban officially submitted its bid to the Commonwealth Games Federation. The Canadian city of Edmonton withdrew its Commonwealth Games bid last month, leaving Durban as the only candidate. The 2022 Commonwealth Games host city is scheduled to be announced in about 6 months in early September. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma, had a chance to talk with the leader of Durban's bid.
South Africa's 2022 Durban Commonwealth Games Bid Committee Chairman Mark Alexander says hosting the Games fits in well with the country's national development plan. Alexander reckons their bid was well received.
We presented our bid in the formal process in London on Monday. It was very well received. There were several ambassadors from the Commonwealth countries who really praised the bid we had. On Tuesday, we met with the CGF and we had a formal meeting with them. Again, the president came out quite strong in support and the quality of our bid. The CGF is working with our government and working with us and to make sure that we can deliver the first African Commonwealth Games.
Although a lot was done during the World Cup, and there are more additions you'll have to do. For instance, there is no athletics track on the main Moses Mabhida Stadium.
Currently in the city's plans, and I think it's planned for 2016, is to install a track. So the track would have been installed regardless of whether we host the games or not. It's part of their long-term planning. As far as the village is concerned, the village in Kenobia is going to happen regardless of the games or not. That is part of the human settlements gap housing plan. That's going to take place regardless.
Are you saying that all aspects which were required for the games are already in the development plans of the city, regardless of whether or not South Africa hosts those games?
That's the difference between our games and what the Canada's budding. We looked at these games and said, how could we plug into our national development plan? As far as the stadiums are concerned, those upgrades were planned anyway. What we will have to do is spruce up some of the stadiums, and there's only one temporary facility we're putting up is for shooting. All the other facilities are there. It's running and people are using it currently. This time around, we want to make sure that the youth of this country benefit from the bid.
That was Mark Alexander, the 2022 Durban Commonwealth Games Bid Committee Chairman, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. In athletics, South Africa's Shanghai Marathon champion, Stephen Mukoka, won the South Africa 10-kilometer championships in 29 minutes and 38 seconds in the capital, Tswane, on Saturday. He then traveled 700 kilometers by road and won the 10 kilometers at the Durban City Marathon in a world-class time of 28 minutes and 33 seconds on Sunday. Mukoka says it's all part of training for the World Cross Country Championships in China later this month.
The most important thing was my fitness level. I think it's on track. For the next 3 weeks, I think if I can focus more on my speed, because I was doing too much of my mileage, so now I'm going to focus on speed. That's why my coach brought us here on the tar track, so that we can do the sharpening part for the World Cross Country.
World Cross Country has been dominated by the East Africa, but last time you did break into that top 20. What is your thinking in terms of going towards the World Cross Country Championships?
Competing with the East Africans in normal races, I mean, if you can find them in a league of cross country or on a road race or on a track meeting, it's always easy to break them. But when you go to championships, those guys, they go to camps, and then when you are in a camp, camping with strong guys, you can't motivate it. And then normally when you find them at the championships, they are very strong. I mean, you can beat a guy today, but when you get to championship, he's strong. But I mean, that's what we are looking forward to. I mean, the most important thing is the teamwork. I'm very excited this time because all the guys that are going, I mean, most of the guys that are running 12 kilometers are my training partners. So if we can be able to work together here training, push each other, maybe if our fitness level is more or less the same, I mean, when we get there, if we can share each other and then fight, I mean, represent the country world, we can be able to, I mean, fight them. But the main important goal for myself is that, I mean, the last time I went to World Cross Country, I finished 15th. She's the fastest ever run by a South African. And then I'm very excited now because the very same guy who ran or who was 15th at some point at cross country will be there at the World Championship. So, I mean, if he was not old, I would say it's a battle between me and him to see who can break that. But I'll be happy if I break that in his presence.
That was Stephen Mukoka, South Africa's Shanghai Marathon champion. I'm Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Tami, tami, waka, waka. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited. Because
this is Africa. Tamina, mina, waka, waka, Tamina, mina, this time for Africa.
VOA's Tef Tef and Downtown Brown join us now with their English Premier League football question of the week.
Hey, this is VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
So the question of the week, we flipped the script, and we wanted you guys to ask us a question. So let's start off with Sonny. Sonny asked me, who is my favorite EPL team? I'm not going to lie, I'm a gunner till I die. Tef, who's your favorite team?
I mean, there's no question. It's Manchester, the best team in the world, Manchester United.
Oh, my goodness. So we're going to have a huge
win of the league.
We're third place right now. They're 1 point behind us. Let's have some fun. Magnus asked me what four teams are going to finish top of the table this year. And I have Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal. And then it's a debate between Liverpool and Man U. Depending on how Man U is playing recently, I'm going to say Liverpool right now.
That's a tough one. I'm going to put my bias in there. I agree with your first two.
I bet you do.
But just because I think, you know, Liverpool is actually a threat, not just to Manchester United, but Arsenal could also be a target. So I think there's going to be a lot of rotation between, three and four and five. So I'm going to say Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool, and Manchester United.
So Stanley Anyakor asked me, how many trophies has Arsenal won and how many trophies has Chelsea won? So Arsenal has a total of 23 trophies. So for Chelsea, 21 trophies, four of them are league titles, seven are FA Cups, and one Champions League title. And I know there's a huge difference, but in my heart, I still think Arsenal is better than Chelsea.
I mean, yeah, Chelsea's a very recent team, so their success started. They were always a liked team, but their success to me started after 2000. So it's a huge accomplishment to do all that in the past 15 years.
Jose Annie asked me who's a better striker, Costa or Aguero? And right now, it's hands down definitely Costa. 17 goals so far. Yeah, I got to go with Costa.
So Joshua Zenit had another question. He said, do you think Frank Lampard let Chelsea down by signing from Man City? I mean, I honestly, I don't think so because, first of all, you know, in a world where there are so many big clubs that switch players around as much as they want, he was a loyal player. They could have given him a contract that was more than a year. The only reason why he had to go to New York was because Chelsea did not offer him a contract that was more than a year. And for somebody who's been there for that long, you would think, okay, you know, they would at least let him play a couple more years regardless of how amazing he is. But so you can't get angry at a person who ends up playing for City because City actually played the system very well. They brought him to New York and then they brought him back on loan. So, you know, it's a lot of times soccer is business and business oriented, and so this is exactly what it comes to. So we can't really blame an individual when the clubs do it all the time.
I was about to say, at the end of the day, business is business. They're going to want to do whatever they can to get a win.
And so the other question that we got is by Amos Okeme Monday. It's a tough one. He said, who is the best box-to-box midfielder in the EPL? I had a very hard time picking this, and I still think in my head I'm undecided. My short list had Fabregas, Silva, Toure, and Sanchez in it. If you asked me this question last season, I would have said Toure hands down. Not because of that year, but just in general, he's a very dominant midfielder. He's helped City win a couple titles in a very short time. This year, to me, it's Sanchez playing as a midfielder / striker has been very effective with goals. Fabregas still has the leading number of assists. And Silva is just, to me, amazing. He just scored recently. He held it down when Aguero and Touré and, you know, Boni with the new signing were not there. So my last decision overall for the past 3-4 years, I'll go with Touré, Yaya Touré.
So moving on to Goodwin Phillipson asks us, Sonny, he asked Sonny a question. Who do you see winning the trophy this year? And Sonny told us to tell you he has Chelsea. And then you also asked another question. Who's his favorite team? And right now it's DC United.
Local team.
Local, very local.
So Ondoma Emmanuel says, I belong to Arsenal FC. Which EPL club has the largest fan base globally? So I had to do some research. I knew it was Manchester United. And, you know, in the past I've seen some numbers. But so United claims to have 659 million fans around the world, which is almost twice the size of America.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I mean, it's insane. And but at the same time, again, these numbers are not, you know, tested and proven, because Liverpool themselves just this year claimed that they have 580 million fans.
So Romeo asks us, how much money is given to EPL winners? And I looked it up last year. Since Man City won, they made $96.5 million. And Liverpool, since they came in second, won even more. They beat them by a million. So they came out with $97.5 million.
So the last question that we received was by Dwayne Nana Kwabena Amisa. I hope I said that right. He says, what could be missing in the EPL? The teams participating in the Champions League don't live up to expectations of late, a major concern. I had this debate with my friends a lot. I think it's because of the EPL's challenging nature. When you go to the dominant teams recently, it's Barcelona and German teams like Bayern Munich, even some Italy teams. It's because there's no competition at home. You know, they can afford to, and I'm not saying it's not, you know, no competition period, because, you know, you always have Real Madrid or Atletico, and then you have six teams, period, who are, could finish top four easily.
Rather than PSG, they just have to focus on one or two teams.
Exactly, Lyon or
the UEFA Champions League.
Exactly.
And then that's the only
focus. And that's the only focus they have. So they can, you know, concentrate more on Europe.
All Arsenal fans, all Manchester United fans, March 9th. Check your local listings for the time. FA Cup match. It's basically
at Old Trafford.
It's basically Downtown Brown versus Tef Tef. We're going to try to get as much detail as we possibly can once the match is over and once the match begins on Sunnyside of Sports.
One fact about that game, by the way, Arsenal and Manchester United both have 11 FA Cups, so they're going to fight it out for who goes on to get a chance for a 12th one.
I'm VOA's Downtown Brown.
And I'm Tef Tef.
Hey, have a great weekend.
You have a great weekend too, fellas. Getting back to Durban and its 2022 Commonwealth Games bid, the Indian Ocean City already has hosted matches at several big sports events, including the 1995 Rugby World Cup, the 2003 Cricket World Cup, and most recently, the 2010 FIFA Football World Cup. Now Durban is vying to be the first African city to stage the Commonwealth Games. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays like today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, a lethal cocktail of conflict risks causing instability this year in West and Central Africa. And two U.S. professors create an online class on hip-hop music and religion. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's L.I.B. Queen of Liberia with A New Day. L.I.B. Queen of Liberia with A New Day. While a lethal cocktail of conflict risks causing instability this year in West and Central Africa, says Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa, Steve Cockburn. He talks with Ricky Schweik about pressing human rights violations he says are currently taking place in both the Gambia and Central African Republic.
2014 was quite a difficult and depressing year in the region, like in many parts of the world. And there's quite a dangerous situation for 2015, quite a lethal cocktail of conflict, of oppression and impunity that does risk causing instability in 2015, especially in a year when there are so many quite sensitive elections happening in the region.
First of all, I wanted to ask about Gambia. What, I guess, is the latest in regards to the people who had been subjected to imprisonment for being accused of plotting the attempted coup against Yahya Jammeh? I know some of the relatives of the accused plotters had been imprisoned.
See, obviously, Gambia's had a context of oppression for the last few years, and it's got very much worse over the, certainly the last 2 years with the introduction of new legislation cracking down on journalists and making it harder to speak out. You know, there's been a lot of movement over the last couple of years, a lot of changes. There's been also new legislation on LGBT communities there who've been repressed and arrested and threatened with torture. Certainly, since the failed coup d'etat, the situation seems to have gotten worse. We had, certainly documented at least 30 people who'd been arrested, family members of the alleged coup plotters in January. Some of those seem to have been released now, but there's still a decent number of those who remain in custody. We do not have access to lawyers. We don't have access to their families. One of the key things that was agreed by Gambia and by the UN is it would be an investigation into the circumstances of the attempted coup d'etat in December. What we were looking for really is to make sure that that investigation also looks into what's happened after the coup d'etat in terms of the arbitrary arrest and the detention, and to make sure the investigators also have access to detention facilities, and we can find out what happened to these people, because although we know some have been released, there's still many, many who remain behind bars and we don't have news of them.
A lot of global attention, I feel like, is not being paid to Central African Republic at this time, but the conflict is very much not over, especially in the rural parts of the country.
The conflict, I mean, in some ways it's less intense than perhaps was in January or February in 2014, but it's very, very much still there.
That was Steve Cockburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director, speaking with VOA's Ricky Shryock. Well, the modern cultural phenomenon called hip-hop might not seem to have much in common with religion, but two professors at Rice University see a lot of similarities. They have structured a popular class around the idea and have produced some videos of their lectures so that people around the world can take the class online. VOA's Greg Flakes has more on the story from Houston, Texas. When you see the
shine, we on the level, those before us never even... Bernard Freeman, better known as the hip-hop rapper Bun B, says hip-hop and religion both examine the basic mysteries of life.
Hip-hop asks the hard questions about life. Why are we here? What is our purpose? Who are we? And we use different lessons within the culture to help people deal with these things and help people try to find these answers.
Bun B developed the course on hip-hop and religion with Rice University religion professor Anthony Pinn, who says faith has long been expressed through music.
And historically, churches have been patrons of the arts. Some of the music that has motivated and moved people for centuries was commissioned by churches.
Pinn also sees a parallel between Christianity, which started as a small Jewish sect in a far corner of the Roman Empire, and hip-hop, which developed partly as a response to gang violence in New York.
Hip-hop culture, born within the context of urban decay from unlikely persons and personalities, goes on to transform how we describe, understand, and work within our world.
Raymond Cano and Dimitri Luke took the hip-hop and religion course and found it rewarding as well as challenging.
If you're passionate about learning and you're curious about it, and you're willing to put in the work, it's an amazing class.
The class delves into social problems and economic challenges that even students face, says Dimitri Luke.
It's not as easy to get a job and to live the same like American dream that we've been living. And I think hip-hop questions that dream.
Both students say they also gained insights into religion and spirituality through the course.
Let's talk about how hip-hop artists use Christian signs and symbols within the culture.
Now, thanks to Rice University placing the course online, students everywhere will be able to sign up and explore the connections between the worldwide spread of hip-hop culture and the deep-rooted traditions of the world's religions. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Zubair Tayeb, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On-again, off-again negotiations to bring peace to South Sudan have resumed with a face-to-face meeting between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar. With a deadline looming to reach a final peace deal, the two men are expected to negotiate major issues that have complicated previous discussions. Though an agreement on the structure and mandate of a transitional government was signed in early February, details regarding power sharing, governance, and security arrangements have proved elusive. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has reached out to the warring parties and strongly urged them to seize the current and final round of negotiations to deliver a sustainable peace. "We are all well past the point where enough is enough," he said. "Leaders must put the interests of their people above their own. The violence must end. A negotiated conclusion to this conflict is required now. Legitimacy is not a presumed right of any government. It is conferred by the people, and it is sustained only by demonstrating leadership to protect and serve all citizens. These are responsibilities the government has neglected. The opposition has likewise failed to choose peace or make the hard choices required of leaders. Both President Kiir and Riek Machar have promised time and again that they would negotiate a transitional government, but have failed to make the compromises necessary. The world is watching to see what the leaders of South Sudan now will do. The United States will work with our international partners, including in the region, the UN Security Council, and beyond, to take further concerted action against those who do not demonstrate a willingness to make the difficult decisions needed for peace. Leaders can choose to do the hard work of implementing peace, or they can all too easily drift back into the nightmare of war. The choice is clear, and for the sake of all the people of South Sudan, they must choose peace.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one, this one,
every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.